I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. The claim at the heart of the Christian faith is that Jesus is God. So how did a Jewish preacher from a rural community executed for crimes against the state come to be viewed as God, creator of all things? Historian and biblical scholar Bart Ehrman is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new book is How Jesus Became God, The Exaltation of a Jewish Preacher from Galilee. His previous books include Misquoting Jesus and Jesus Interrupted. He joins us on the phone from North Carolina. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Perhaps we should start with a bit about your beliefs. You were once an evangelical Christian and are now agnostic, and your approach to this book is really from a historical perspective.
That's right. I don't deal with the question theologically, so I don't deal with the question whether Jesus really is God or not. I'm dealing with how it is that Christians came to say he was God. The premise is that during his lifetime, Jesus was not spending his ministry teaching that he was the second member of the Trinity. But in 300 years, that's exactly what Christians were saying about him. And so the question is, how do you get from point A to point B?
Right. So this question of how Jesus became God, you say, is an important one, not just for Christians, but for all of us, regardless of our religious affiliation, or if you're agnostic or an atheist. And that's because of the historical significance. Because if Jesus had never been declared God, we would be a whole different story.
It'd be a very different story because as soon as Christians started calling Jesus God, they opened up the possibility that they would become something other than a strictly Jewish sect. They became attracted to the non-Jews, and so they started having massive conversions to this religion. By the beginning of the fourth Christian century, so 300 years after Jesus, about 5% of the empire was Christian by this time, so maybe 3 million people. But, you know, that wouldn't have happened if Jesus hadn't been declared God, and if those massive conversions hadn't happened, then the Emperor Constantine almost certainly would not have converted to this new faith, and if Constantine had not converted, then the Roman Empire would not have become a Christian state, and if the empire hadn't become a Christian state, we wouldn't have the Middle Ages or the Renaissance or the Reformation or modernity as we know it.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, isn't it?
it's a big issue.
Yeah.
And it all hinges on this declaration that Jesus was God, so that even if somebody, I mean, for Christians, obviously, it's very important to know how and why Christians started calling Jesus God. But for the non-Christian, it's important, too, because it's changed our civilization.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because in the book jacket, you say, written for secular historians of religion and believers alike, how Jesus became God will engage anyone interested in the historical developments that led to the affirmation at the heart of Christianity, Jesus was and is God. And I think that's tough to do, to write a book that's attractive to secular and religious people.
It is tough to do, and it means that there has to be a bit of a balancing act, especially because I have to talk about things like what happened when the followers of Jesus said he got raised from the dead. That's an important issue, obviously, for Christians, but you know, the trick is how to handle that so that what one says could be acceptable to both Christians and non-Christians.
Yeah, we're going to get to that, but I thought it was an interesting start to the book where you're describing a man, a son of God, that as you're reading, you expect you're going to say it's Jesus, but in fact, it's, I don't know if I'm going to say this right,
Apollonius.
Apollonius, thank you, who actually lived after Jesus, yet some saw these two divine men as being in competition.
Right. So Apollonius was a man from Tiana, a town called Tiana in what's now Turkey. And what I do in the book is I explain that that his mother had a heavenly visitant before he was born, saying that her child would be a divine being, and he was miraculously born. And then he, as an adult, he went on an itinerant preaching ministry, and he gathered disciples around him, and they thought he was the Son of God. And he proved it by doing miracles, by healing the sick and casting out demons and raising the dead. And at the end of his life, he ascended to heaven. And so, you know, but that's not Jesus. That's Apollonius of Tiana. And so part of my point in starting the book that way is to show that in the ancient world, Jesus was not the only miracle-working Son of God that people were talking about. There, in fact, were others like him.
Yeah, and that's an important point. And I want to talk about that in a second, what the beliefs in the ancient world were. But I think part of the challenge for you and other scholars is this investigation is to determine which stories are historically accurate and which are not. And as we know, there's not a lot written. So what is that process? How do you determine that?
Well, it's very complicated, and you know, it's not a matter of simply taking what an ancient source says and then say, well, that's historical. I mean, I don't really believe that Apollonius of Tyana was raising the dead or healing the sick. The sources say that he did, and so how does the historian deal with those sources? And it's obviously a more pressing problem with the historical Jesus. We have four Gospels in the New Testament. We have a number of Gospels not in the New Testament. Almost everybody agrees these other Gospels are late and legendary in character, but what about the New Testament Gospels? And so historians have to deal with this problem that the Gospels are written by believers, for believers, presupposing faith, and they're not written in order to provide history lessons for 21st century historians. And so how can we use them then? And historians have developed criteria for using sources like this so that we can apply these criteria rigorously and try and figure out what actually happened in history.
And of course, there are some non-Christian sources that also show that Jesus existed, right?
Yeah, there are non-Christian sources. There's the Jewish historian Josephus, who's writing in the first century, who shows knowledge of Jesus. And we have later Roman sources that say a few things about him. Most of our sources, though, are Christian sources, and the best Christian sources are the ones in the New Testament. So whether a person is a Christian or not, if somebody wants to do a historical study of Jesus, they pretty much are limited to the books found in the New Testament, especially the Gospels.
And then, of course, when you think back, you're trying to determine what Jesus might have said or not said, what he preached. This is where we have to look at the times to see what fits into the historical context. And one of the things that you have to take into account, you say, is the Christians meant different things over time when they said Jesus is God.
This is a key point in my book, and I stress it in the book because today, if somebody says that Jesus is God, they have a very set notion what that means, and they don't think that there could be a variety of ways in which that statement could be true. And what I show in the book is that early Christians, different Christians, meant different things when they said Jesus was God. And the reason for that is because the divine realm, the realm of God, was understood differently in the ancient world from the way it's understood today.
Explain that. Explain what the difference is.
Well, today we think of God as up there and completely different from the rest of us. God is all powerful. God is all knowing, and we're mere peons. And so there's this massive chasm between God and us. In the ancient world, people didn't see it that way. Whether they were Greek or Roman or Jewish, people thought that the divine realm was layered, that there were various levels of divinity. So there could be one superior God, and in Judaism, of course, the creator God is the God of the Old Testament. But even in Roman and Greek circles, there could be one superior God. But under that one God, there were lots of other divine beings, some of them were more powerful than others. And so that was true also in Judaism, which held to the idea that, yes, there's the one creator God, but there's also other divine beings. There are angels and archangels and cherubim and seraphim and principalities and powers and all sorts of divine beings. And so if somebody says Jesus became a divine being, that doesn't necessarily mean that he became the God who created the universe. It could mean something else.
Yeah, depending on the time you're talking about. So let's talk about divine humans in ancient Greece and Rome and the emperor cult.
Yeah. So one of the things I try to show in the book is that Romans and Greeks had an idea that sometimes, since you have these levels of divinity, sometimes the stratum of divinity overlapped the stratum of humanity, so that there could be people who were at the same time both human and divine, like Apollonius of Tyana, but also like the emperors. The emperors were many of the emperors were were thought to be gods. And when somebody said the emperor is God, they didn't mean that the emperor is Zeus, you know, or that the emperor is Jupiter, or that the emperor is one of the great gods of Mount Olympus. The emperor was a low-level divinity. But the logic is that there are some human beings who are, as we all know, who are far more intelligent than the rest of us, mm-hmm. or far more powerful, or far more beautiful. And sometimes it was understood that these people were made into divine beings because the gods were showing favor to them. And so that's what happened with the emperors. They were far more powerful than anyone else, and so they were thought to be gods.
And of course, sometimes it would be, somebody who was maybe saved their kingdom from something, so they were seen as a savior. But I thought it was interesting that Caligula at one time was considered a divine.
Yes, well, Caligula, who was a terrible emperor, promoted the idea that he was God while he was living. A lot of the other emperors weren't very happy with being thought of as gods while they were living, and you know, I mean, it was obvious they were human as well, but there were some emperors who promoted the idea that they themselves were God, and people bought it. You know, people worshipped Caligula as a god.
And pagans also thought there were these many different gods as well, right?
Yeah, and that's right. Well, I mean, when we talk about Greeks and Romans, basically, you know, for the most part, that we are talking about pagans and mm-hmm. as people who are polytheists. You know, they believe in many gods, and when polytheists believe in many gods, these different gods have different functions, and they're at different levels. Some are more powerful than others.
Yeah. And I mentioned emperor cult, and you explain in the book it's not the way we think of the word cult today.
That's right. Today, when somebody talks about a cult, they usually refer to some kind of secretive and kind of crazy society of people doing weird things, religious acts. And that's not what the word means for historians. For ancient historians, the word cult comes from the Latin term cultus deorum, which means the care of the gods. And so cult simply means any way that you participate in worship of the gods, which in the ancient world generally meant performing sacrifices to the gods and saying prayers to them. That was the cult.
Yeah. I think some may be surprised, and we've touched on this, to learn that Jesus was not the only savior god known in the ancient world.
No, he wasn't. There certainly were others, so that when the Christians started calling Jesus God, this was not done as a novelty. When Christians started calling Jesus God is precisely when the Romans were calling their emperors God. And so, in fact, this was a competition of sorts between the Christian understanding of who the God-man is and who the Romans thought the God-man was.
We are talking with Bart Ehrman. His new book is How Jesus Became God. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with historian and biblical scholar Bart Ehrman about his new book, How Jesus Became God. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So it was on a trip to Turkey that you had an aha moment when you read an ancient Greek inscription that referred to the god Caesar Augustus. So tell us about that.
Right, yeah, it was a striking moment. I was in Turkey with a friend, another scholar. We were visiting archaeological sites, and we were at the ancient city called Priene, which is in ruins but has been partially reconstructed. It has inscriptions lying on the ground everywhere around a temple that was there. And I was just looking at one of these Greek inscriptions and trying to make it out, and I realized that it was dedicated to the god Caesar Augustus. And when I saw that, it struck me. I had known this for years, but it never really hit me before, that precisely when the Romans were calling their emperors God is when Christians started calling Jesus God. And I realized at that moment that this was not an accident, that this was going on at the same time. So Christians were not doing this in a vacuum. They were doing it in response to what was going on in the wider environment.
So it was a competition.
it was a competition between Jesus and the emperor.
Yeah. Tell us, you had done some work prior to that in Priene, which I thought was interesting. Talk about that project you worked on.
Right. So Priene was important to me. This was the first time I had been there, but I had, when I was a graduate student at Princeton Theological Seminary, and right after that when I had graduated, I was working at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton on a project called the Princeton Epigraphy Project. Epigraphy has to do with inscriptions, and my job was to edit published inscriptions to make them available in a digital form. And so I spent my days editing inscriptions, and I edited all the inscriptions from Priene as part of my job. And so I had this kind of knowledge about Priene before, but then when I went there and actually saw this inscription, it was especially a vivid moment for me.
Yeah, it's funny how you can be right there in it and not it's much later when you have that kind of lightning bolt that hits you.
Absolutely.
So when you saw this, now you have to look at, you know, what was Judaism in the ancient world, and what did you find?
I'm sorry, what was
what? What was Judaism in the ancient world?
Yeah, so this is the surprising thing for many people about my book, is that people, of course, know that in the pagan realm there are all sorts of gods, and that humans can become God. And what people don't realize is that the same thing can be said about Judaism. Even in Judaism, they have the idea that some humans can be exalted up to the divine realm as a favor of God. In the first century, for example, there were Jews who said that Moses had become a god, and there were Jews who said that Enoch had become a god. And they also understood, the way pagans did, that sometimes divine beings could have offspring with mortal beings, so that divine beings, the sons of God, could sometimes come down and have sexual intercourse with women and create kind of demigods. There's a reference to this already in the book of Genesis, chapter 6, where this happens right before the flood. And of course, God himself can take on human shape in the Hebrew Bible. What is also striking, though, is that sometimes humans in the Hebrew Bible are called God. The king of Israel, on several occasions, is called God, El, in the Hebrew Bible. So people overlook these things, but it's quite important because it shows that even Jews understood that humans could also be divine.
Yeah, it's really interesting the research that goes into this, because it really is a lot about interpretation, and you really do have to kind of look at what's happening in each time period.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think one of the problems people have studying the Bible is that they treat it as if it was written in 21st century America. And anytime you take anything out of its context, you change its meaning. If you take the Bible out of its context, you change its meaning. And what makes it especially complicated is that the different books of the Bible were written in different contexts. They're not all the same context. And so you really have to situate each individual writing in its own historical context if you want to understand it.
Dana is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning. Thank you. And hello, Mr. Herman. I have a question. Might seem like a simplistic one, but do you think there was something remarkable about Jesus as a man, that was he gifted in some unique way that maybe had people attributing divinity to him?
That's a good question, Dana.
Yeah, that's a good question. What I argue in my book is that during Jesus' public ministry, he did not call himself God, and he was not understood by any of his disciples to be God. That was something that happened, it started happening right after his death. I think Jesus must have been a remarkable man. I mean, he was obviously quite brilliant and insightful, and probably had a charismatic personality. But I don't think anybody thought of him as God until after his death.
Dana, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you have a question or a comment. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You talk about what we know or think we know about Jesus has come from a source, but, you know, could be somebody told us something, we read something, but we have to question, like, where did this information come from? right? I mean, every story about Jesus, or as you write, this is what you write, every story about Jesus or any other historical figure either is historically accurate, something he really said or did, or is made up, or is a combination of the two. So ancient sources are great, but what do we have?
Right. Well, so that's the problem. You know, I've never quite understood why, but people seem to think that their knowledge of Jesus comes to them immediately somehow, that there's just some kind of innate sense about who Jesus was. But Jesus is like any other historical figure. If you're going to know about him, you have to have sources of information. And everybody who says anything about Jesus has sources of information, or else they're making it up. And the only real sources of information we have about Jesus are the Gospels of the New Testament. Those are problematic as historical sources. I'm not denying their value as theological sources or as books of faith, but for somebody who wants to know what really happened in the life of Jesus, one has to look at them very carefully because, as I was saying before, they're written by Christians for Christians, and they have a Christian point of view, and they're written many decades after the fact. The earliest gospel we have is probably Mark, which was written probably around the year 70 of the Common Era. In other words, it's 40 years after the facts. Mm-hmm. And it's our earliest gospel. So that one has to approach these books from a historical point of view in order to know what really happened in the life of Jesus.
Right. Scott is giving us a call from Marston's Mills. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Your guest might have partially or fully answered my question, but I'll ask it anyway. So from a historical, from the perspective of an historian, what do you think about the claims that Jesus performed so-called miracles?
Right. So, you know, it's a great question, and I have to deal with it explicitly in my book because, you know, on virtually every page of the Gospels, Jesus is doing miracles. I mean, he's born miraculously, he heals the sick and casts out demons and raises the dead and walks on water and multiplies loaves. I mean, he's doing miracles all the time. What I argue in the book, and it's kind of a long argument. It's a little bit hard to say it in 20 seconds.
Well, you can take a few minutes if you need it. Go ahead.
Well,
we got time.
Okay. What I argue is that historians, by the very nature of the historical disciplines, are not able to talk about whether miracles happened in the past. This isn't just about miracles of Jesus. It's miracles of anybody. Historians, there are two reasons for this. One reason is that historians are writing accounts about what happened in the past that are acceptable to other historians, which means that historians, among the presuppositions of the historians have to be presuppositions that other historians agree with. So when you read an account of World War II, you will never, ever read an account of World War II by a reputable historian that says that the reason the Allies won is because the Martians came down and directed the course of the Battle of the Bulge and made sure that, in fact, in the end, the Allies would triumph over the Axis powers. Now, why don't historians? I mean, maybe that did happen. But even if it did happen, historians can't say that's what happened because it presupposes things like there's life on other planets, and Mars is one of them, and the intelligent life of Mars intervenes in intelligent life here on Earth. It presupposes things that most historians simply don't buy. So if historians can only write history based on what are common presuppositions, they have to be presuppositions that are shared not just by Christian historians, but also Jewish and Muslim and Buddhist and agnostic and atheist and all other historians. Otherwise, it's not history. It's imposing faith views on history. But if you impose faith views on history, you're no longer doing history. You're doing theology. And which is fine. There is absolutely no problem with doing theology. But if you're doing theology, you can't call it history. It's not the same thing. So what I argue in the book, that's just one of the arguments I have. I have several other arguments. But basically, historians are unable to talk about miracle, because to talk about miracle presupposes that there's a God who's active in this world, who intervenes sometimes. And that might be absolutely right. There may be a God who intervenes in the world, but that's not a view that's shared by all historians, and so historians can't invoke miraculous in order to talk about what happened in the past.
Scott, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So one of the most controversial topics centers on the resurrection of Jesus and what we can and cannot know about that. And you've got a whole chapter on that.
Right. And the reason it's the key is because, as I was saying before, Jesus himself does not appear to have called himself God during his public ministry, according to our earliest Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That isn't what he was preaching about. And according to those Gospels, none of his disciples thought he was God during his public ministry. But soon after his death, his disciples were saying that he was, in some sense, God. And the key is that they came to think that he was raised from the dead. And so it's of crucial importance to understand what it is that led the disciples to say that Jesus was raised from the dead. And so that's why I devote two chapters of this to this question, approaching it not from the theological point of view of faith, but from a historical point of view. What can historians say about the belief in the resurrection? And so, you know, obviously, since I don't think that historians can talk about miracles, I don't think historians can say Jesus probably was raised from the dead. And historians can't say, well, so I've proved that Jesus did not rise from the dead. It's outside of what historians can talk about. But historians can talk about why it is the disciples said Jesus was raised from the dead. And here I make a very strong argument that there was one and only one reason why the disciples said Jesus was raised from the dead. It had nothing to do with them discovering a tomb that was empty. It had everything to do with the fact that they claimed they had seen Jesus alive after his death. And so I spend an entire chapter talking about what we know about visions of people after they died, because we have lots of other cases of people having visions of people after they died. Lots of people have visions of deceased loved ones after their death. And lots of people have visions of revered religious figures, such as the Blessed Virgin Mary, who shows up alive all over the place in completely well-documented instances to hundreds and thousands of people. The interesting thing about Jesus is that he was both a deceased loved one and a revered religious figure. And so I argue it's not at all implausible that some of the disciples saw him afterwards. So what Christians would say, the reason they saw him was because he was raised from the dead and he appeared to them. What non-Christians would say is that they had hallucinations. And so so that's what I focus on in the book, without taking a stand about why it is, you know, whether Jesus really appeared to them or not.
Right. I thought it was also interesting, the section on the policies of Pontius Pilate.
Right. So in the context of all that argument, I have to deal with the question of whether there really was an empty tomb or not. And I've come to think that, in fact, the stories about Jesus being buried by Joseph of Arimathea are probably legendary, and that they're not historical stories. And my reason for thinking that is that the typical practices of crucifixion by the Romans required them to leave the bodies on the crosses for several days after the person died, so that death by crucifixion wasn't merely the torture of being executed in that way. It was the punishment was also the ravages on the body that were wreaked after death, so that a person was not given a decent burial usually, but was left to hang there to decompose and to be attacked by scavengers. So that was the standard practice of Romans, and so I ask whether, in fact, there would have been an exception made in the case of Jesus, and I argue that given what we know about Pontius Pilate, it's highly unlikely that Pilate would have granted a decent burial for Jesus' body when that wasn't the normal practice.
Yeah, he was not really known to be a kind man.
He was not a kind man. We have several stories about him from the Jewish historian Josephus, and he's referred to by the Jewish philosopher Philo, and he was a mean-spirited, very tough and hard-nosed administrator who really didn't care about Jewish sensibilities, so that I don't think that he really would have caved into any Jewish threats or anything like that. He ruled with an iron fist.
And you say that there were some ancient Christians who maintained that Jesus was raised in the spirit, not in the body.
Right. So the question is, if Jesus is raised from the dead, in what sense was he raised from the dead? And there were Christians who thought that maybe his spirit came back to life, but his body decomposed. And there were other Christians who said that his body came back to life, but it was transformed into a supernatural body. That's what the Apostle Paul thought, for example. There were others who thought that his body was reanimated, so that it wasn't transformed into a different body. It was actually the very same body with the wound holes still in the body. That's what the Gospel of Luke thinks, for example, and the Gospel of John. So that there were different understandings of what it meant to say Jesus was raised from the dead. What I argue is that the very earliest disciples, Jesus' own disciples, believed that the body actually came out of the tomb and was taken up into heaven, and that it's at that point that Jesus was made God. Because ancient people understood that if a person was taken up to heaven, that made him a divine being. And so that's the beginning of the belief that Jesus was God.
Right. Now, the other thing that's interesting that you point out, and not just in this book, but in a couple of others, is that most of the ancient world could not read or write. They were illiterate.
Yeah, I know. This comes as a surprise to people today because, most people we know are illiterate. We have a very high literacy rate in the United States, but they had very low literacy rates in the Roman Empire. The best estimates indicate that only something like 10% of the Roman Empire could read and write, and that 10% would be the upper crust elite. The literacy rates in Palestine were even lower. The best estimates indicate that in Palestine in the days of Jesus, maybe 3% of the population could read and write, and more people could read than could write. It's for that reason that the traditions about Jesus, his life and his death and his resurrection, were passed along almost exclusively by word of mouth. Because people couldn't write, and most people couldn't read.
Yeah, and of course, we know it's like the game telephone. You know, when you tell the person a story, by the time it gets down the line, it sometimes changes quite a bit.
It can change quite a bit right off the bat, and people remember what they hear differently, and then they tell the story. Different people hear the same story, but they'll change it in their own minds as they remember it, and then they'll retell it, and those people who hear it the second time then will hear it differently, and they'll tell it differently themselves, and so it goes on like that for decades.
Yeah, so that goes back to the importance of looking at what the culture of the time, whatever time period we're talking about, what was common in that time.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Because people who are telling these stories are telling them in light of what they think and what they believe and what their worldview is, and all these things are affecting how they tell the stories.
We're talking with historian and biblical scholar Bart Ehrman. His new book is How Jesus Became God. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with historian and biblical scholar Bart Ehrman. His new book is How Jesus Became God. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to chime in, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Another interesting fact that maybe some people aren't aware of is the doctrine of the Trinity was a later development in the Christian tradition.
Right. It became a standard doctrine of the church and continues to be. But what I show in the book, what I show isn't anything novel. This isn't my idea. This is just historical information that scholars have long known, is that the doctrine of the Trinity was a slow development. The first person ever to use the term Trinity was a church father named Tertullian, writing around the year 200 or so. But the doctrine of the Trinity didn't develop very firmly until the 4th century. So the problem the Christians had was they started calling Jesus God, and they developed different ways of understanding how Jesus could be God. But the difficulty was that they also wanted to say that God the Father was God, and then they wanted to say that the Holy Spirit was God, and yet they wanted to say there's only one God. And so how do you do that? Because if Jesus is God and the Spirit is God and God the Father is God, you've got three gods. But Christians insisted, no, we have only one God. And so different solutions were devised in order to figure out how that could be. So, for example, there were Christians that said that God exists in three modes of existence, so that just as I myself am at the same time a son and a brother and a father, God is like that. He is at the same time the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. That ended up being declared a heresy, though, because it didn't allow for the distinctiveness of the three persons of the Trinity. And, you know, people pointed out that when Jesus was on earth and was praying, he wasn't simply talking to himself. So that view got rejected. And they ended up then with the idea that there is only one God, but he's manifest in three persons who are distinct from each other, Father, Son, and Spirit, but each one is fully and completely God and equal with one another. And that's then the doctrine of the Trinity, one God manifest in three persons.
You write that Jesus is best understood as an apocalyptic prophet who was anticipating that God was soon to intervene in human affairs to overthrow the forces of evil and set up a good kingdom here on earth. So you also mentioned in the book that you speak to a lot of different groups around the country, and there are a couple of questions that you get often. First is, if this is the view widely held among scholars, why have I never heard it before?
Yes, that is a very common question. This view that Jesus himself, during his public ministry, was not going around teaching that he was the second member of the Trinity, but instead was preaching the coming kingdom of God that was to arrive very soon in a cataclysmic act of judgment. This view was first popularized by Albert Schweitzer back in 1906, and it's been the majority view among scholars in Europe and the United States ever since. There's very good evidence supporting it. But it's absolutely not the view of Jesus that gets taught in most churches. Even though pastors in most mainline churches, meaning, you know, whether Lutheran or Methodist or Presbyterian or Episcopalian, these pastors all learned this view when they were in seminary. But they seem not to tell it to their congregations.
Why? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of pastors don't want to make waves. They don't want to ruffle feathers. They want to build faith, and they don't want to disturb faith, and they realize that, in fact, this can be very disturbing information. I think it's too bad, because it means that people who would be in an education class, an adult education class in a church, would expect to get educated, and you would think that this would be the opportunity to tell people what it is biblical scholars say about the Bible. But that obviously isn't being done, which means people are not really getting educated in these education classes.
And the second question you get a lot is if other Jews in Jesus' day taught this apocalyptic view, then why Jesus? Why is it that Jesus started Christianity?
Yeah, no, and it's another great question, and it goes back to what we were talking about before. This view, this apocalyptic view, is found, for example, in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was a view held by Pharisees. It was a view held by John the Baptist. It was a view held by other prophets. And so why Christianity, and why not a religion, for example, based on John the Baptist? Well, the reason is, apparently, that it was Jesus who was said to have been raised from the dead. We don't have indications of other prophets being thought to be resurrected. When Jesus was thought to be resurrected, his followers said he's been taken up into heaven and he's been made a divine being. And so they began revering him as a divine being, and we have no record of anything like that happening with other Jewish prophets.
David is calling from Hyannis. Good morning, David.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier you spoke about the fact that the Gospels were written at the very earliest decades after the historical events, and you made reference to the game of telephone. I've often heard this argument used as a way of sort of dismissing the historical validity of the resurrection. And I think it often reveals our own sort of societal biases. Just so you know, I'm coming at this not as a, not from a Christian perspective, but as a student of Native American studies, and where oral tradition is very much a valid means of passing things down from generation to generation. I just wonder if your guest could speak to the, whether or not societies that have a strong oral tradition but lack literacy have a more robust oral tradition. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Yes, I'd be very happy to talk about that. You're absolutely right. They do have a very robust oral tradition. But what happens in oral societies, as cultural anthropologists have shown conclusively, is that when traditions get passed along orally, they're not retained in the same form every time they're told and retold. Oral cultures don't value the idea of retaining things with precise accuracy. When stories get told in oral tradition, in oral cultures, it's understood that the stories are supposed to be changed according to the context within which they're being told, which can be just on the level of the audience. What is the audience and what is the occasion? You change the story accordingly. And then, of course, when somebody retells the story that they've heard that's been changed, they themselves change it according to their audience and their context. So the traditions in oral cultures are indeed robust, but that does not mean that they're kept the same every time they're told. Just the contrary, they're changed whenever they're told.
You write, quote, "I would argue that Jesus has always been recontextualized by people living in different times and places."
Well, that's right, because people understand Jesus in light of their own lives and in light of their own contexts. So that if for example, if you take what a 21st century American who, say, a Southern Baptist, what that person thinks about Jesus, you can compare it with what a 18th century Anglican thought about Jesus, and you can compare that with what a 13th century Roman Catholic thought about Jesus, and you can compare that with, you can compare these understandings of who Jesus is, and it's quite clear they're very different from each other, even though each person thinks that they have the right view of Jesus. So, you know, only a theologian could say which side is right, but it's true that everybody has a different understanding of Jesus, and it's almost certainly the case because people are living in different contexts and understand Jesus' relevance to them based on what they need in their own context.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Going back to that question of why Jesus, you have a little section here where you write, some believe that because he was so unique, he was God, and, you know, God is on their side. And I thought it was interesting just the rapid spread of Christianity throughout ancient Rome. And then also, there was a 40% increase every 10 years. But what's interesting is the same was true for the Mormon faith.
Yeah. So, Christianity started out as a small group of Jesus followers. After his death, a group of followers came to think he was raised from the dead, and they started growing. And so, as I pointed out earlier, by the beginning of the 4th century, 300-some years later, they number something like 3 million people. And so how do you get from a handful of people to 3 million people in 300 years? Well, you might think that you need big evangelistic rallies, sort of Billy Graham events where thousands of people come forward to become Christian. But there's no evidence that Christians had those kinds of evangelistic rallies. And it's not clear exactly how they went around converting people, but it looks like mainly it was they were converting friends and families and neighbors on a kind of one-on-one basis. So that seems like you have to have mass conversions. But so there's a sociologist of religion named Rodney Stark who's actually crunched the numbers, and he argues that if you just crunch the numbers, all you need in the Christian church, if you start out with this handful and end up with 3 million, you need to grow at a rate of about 40% every decade. So if right now you've got 100 people, in 10 years you need to have 140 people. And then you just keep growing at that rate. And it's like compound interest. After a while, you're making a ton of money and you're not quite sure why. Well,
yeah.
It's just the way interest works. So, if that's the case, that would, you know, that'd be very interesting. And as you said, it's also interesting because that's the rate of growth of the Mormon Church from its founding until today. So there's nothing miraculous about it. It's just, unless you're a Mormon and you think it's all a miracle, but otherwise it's the way some religions have grown.
Yeah. I think people would be interested to know how you became agnostic.
Right. So, I was a very strong evangelical Christian who believed in the infallibility of the Bible. I went to a fundamentalist Bible college, Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, and was firmly committed to the Bible. When I went off to graduate school, I started being able to read the New Testament in the Greek, original Greek language, and I read the Old Testament in the original Hebrew language, and I studied it more. And I started finding that, in fact, there are mistakes in the Bible. There are contradictions and discrepancies and historical errors. And once you start seeing them and you realize it's possible they could be there, you start seeing a lot of them. Eventually, I became a very liberal Christian. And I was a liberal Christian for many years, still believing in God and thinking that Christ was God's was sort of God's manifestation on earth in some way. But I was liberal. I didn't believe in the inerrancy of the Bible. What eventually made me an agnostic was unrelated to my scholarship. It was the problem of suffering and how one explains that there can be so much pain and misery in this world if there's a God who's in control of it. I thought about this for years. I read what biblical scholars said and what philosophers said, what popular authors said. I just got to a point where I didn't believe it anymore. I just didn't believe that there's a God who's active in this world, who answers prayer, who intervenes, when there's so much starvation and drought and earthquakes and hurricanes and tsunamis. And, you know, so I ended up realizing, you know, I just don't believe there's a God who's active anymore. And at that point, I became an agnostic.
I know we should say you've written a whole book on that. That's God's Problem, if anybody wants to read more about that. An interesting point that you've made about Christianity and the Bible, you say that when you live in the South, Christianity is very much about the Bible. But most Christians in other parts of the work faith, it's not about belief in the Bible, but about believing in Christ and worshiping God.
That's right. Well, it's Christianity. It's not Biblianity. But in where I live in the South, people say that if you don't believe in the Bible, you can't be a Christian. I point out to them that historically there have been creeds that every Christian has had to profess that summarize the faith. For example, the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed. And these creeds don't say one word about the Bible. Because the Bible is never supposed to have been the object of faith. In Christianity, Christ is the object of faith and God through Christ. The Bible may be the revelation for Christians that tell them about God and Christ, but the Bible is not supposed to be believed in. The Bible is supposed to be a guide for faith and practice. So this idea that you have to believe in the Bible to be a Christian is really, it's a completely modern notion, and it's contrary to historical Christianity.
Now, your books certainly stir up some controversy from time to time. What's been the reaction to this book?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there was a group of evangelical Christians knew that this was going to be a book they weren't going to agree with, and so they decided to write a response book to this book before it even appeared. And so this was a group of people. I actually knew some of these authors, and I agreed to show them my manuscript in advance, and they wrote a book in response that appeared the same week my book did. Their book, my book is called How Jesus Became God, and they called their book, as you might expect, How God Became Jesus. And so it's basically an attempt to answer my views. And it's an interesting book in some ways, but I actually found it a little bit disappointing because you would think with that title, How God Became Jesus, they would explain how God became Jesus. But they don't. Their book, in fact, is just meant to take issue with things that I have to say rather than coming up with some alternative explanation. Mm-hmm. I just think that's unfortunate because it leaves a person not having some other way of looking at things other than the one that I laid out that they don't like.
Right. And you also write a blog, right?
I write a blog every day, 5 or 6 days a week, about 1,000 words a day, the Bart Ehrman blog, and I write about the New Testament and the history of early Christianity and the historical Jesus and things that my readers are interested in. It's a membership blog. People have to pay to join. Mm-hmm. I do that because I use every penny that I get from membership fees to give to charities. Mm-hmm. And so I use the blog to support charities dealing with hunger and homelessness. Mm-hmm. And so I raised $60,000 last year. And I hope to raise a lot more as people join the blog, but it's worth the money.
All right, well, we'll put a link up on our website, capeandislands.org. Historian and biblical scholar Bart Ehrman, he's the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new book, How Jesus Became God. Bart, always interesting to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.